Previously on Bad Cops. A secret investigation is underway into an elite plainclothes police unit, the Gun Trace Task Force. On a wiretap, FBI agent Erica Jensen learns that one of the squad's detectives is pretty close to a Baltimore heroin dealer. It's suspicious, but she needs more than that. And then an incriminating call.
Definitely somebody's been tracking you. You're definitely going to get rid of it.
It was what we would call like the dirty call, the criminal call.
Get in, Taylor, get in.
And later, listening to a bug hidden in the cop's car, Agent Jensen hears a group of the task force officers start a car chase that ends in a massive wreck. But the officers do nothing to help.
No light.
Instead, they flee the scene, and they plot how to cover it up.
To me, it was just the dereliction of duty, the way they hid, you know, and stood by, but yet didn't assist. It just bothered me a lot. You know, I was angry about it.
Instead of a couple of dirty cops, she's now thinking most of the unit is rotten. And the guy giving the orders is the Baltimore Police Department's golden boy, Sergeant Wayne Jenkins. I'm Jessica Lussenhop, and this is Bad Cops from the BBC World Service. The true story of Baltimore's Gun Trace Task Force. Part 3. The warning signs.
Hey, yo, y'all get that open yet?
Hold on, we on.
Hey, Sarge!
Whoa.
Hey, come downstairs right quick!
This is the Gun Trace Task Force making a big bust. One of the officers is filming it on his mobile phone. They're in a dim basement of a twice-convicted drug dealer. He's been out of prison for a while.
They're about to get it open. Hold on. Go ahead.
Two of the officers are hunched over a small safe.
They're trying
to pry it open with a crowbar. Suddenly, the lock cracks.
All right, hold on. Take it out.
Inside, bundles and bundles of cash.
Take a picture of it, Tim, or record it right now.
Hold on.
Nobody touches it. You understand me right now. Nobody.
The voice giving the orders.
Don't touch it. Stand next to it. We're calling out the feds.
That's the leader of the unit, Sergeant Wayne Jenkins. He's known for getting guns off the streets, seizing money and drugs, and taking down the city's dealers with high-profile busts like this one.
Keep recording. No one's touching this money.
Yes, sir.
It's the kind of bust Jenkins is famous for. It's why his superiors love him. It makes his bosses look good in front of their bosses. But let's stop right there. Because this video, something's not quite right with it. Let's rewind to earlier that day. Jenkins is out driving around with some of the other officers from the task force. He's on the lookout, scanning the streets for signs of suspicious activity. And what Jenkins considers suspicious is subjective. Like, there are certain makes or models of cars that he calls dope boy cars. In his mind, they're the kind of cars only drug dealers drive. Just being behind the wheel of one of these is enough to get you pulled over. Another word for this is profiling. And when it comes to writing the arrest report, he'll just make something up. Maybe you weren't wearing a seatbelt, or your taillight was out. He's going to use any excuse to stop you, yank you out of the driver's seat, and start digging through your car. So, earlier that day, Jenkins is out cruising in his car in northwest Baltimore when he spots a guy walking down the street carrying a backpack. To Jenkins, this is another tell. A guy with a backpack can mean only one thing. He's holding drugs or guns. The guy with the backpack climbs into the passenger seat of a minivan. Jenkins drives up the wrong way of a one-way street and boxes the vehicle in. There are two men inside, and the officers haul them both out. And it turns out, in this case, Jenkins' instincts were correct. When they search the van, they find half a kilo of cocaine and some cash. There's something about the guy in the driver's seat that interests Jenkins. He thinks he's got what he calls a monster. That's his name for a dealer who might be sitting on a pile of drugs and cash at home. And Jenkins wants to get into this particular monster's house. So he arrests him. And just before the man's driven away to be booked, Jenkins takes his house keys.
All right, hold on. Take it out.
That's how Jenkins and the others wind up in the man's basement, trying to force open the safe. On the video, you can see them open it and find close to $100,000 in cash inside.
Nobody touches, you understand me, right now.
That's Jenkins telling his crew not to touch the money.
Don't touch it, stand next to it, we're calling out the feds.
It's an impressive bust. Here's the thing, though. This whole recording, it's a lie. This is what really happened. When the squad first arrived at the dealer's home, they entered without a warrant. They call it a sneak and peek, and it's totally illegal. They wandered around the dealer's house, helping themselves to a few kilos of cocaine and a $4,000 wristwatch. And then they headed for the basement. The first time they broke into the safe, when they weren't filming, they found $200,000, and they took half for themselves, stuffing the bundles of cash into a bag. And then, minutes later, they act out the whole scene again for the camera, gasping in disbelief at their discovery of $100,000.
Oh, shit!
It's quite a performance.
Hold on.
Once you know it's fake, the video's almost funny. But things just got very real for the twice-convicted drug dealer they just robbed. His name's Orice Stevenson, and he's now sitting in a jail cell downtown. The task force officers bring enough of his cocaine and cash back to the Baltimore Police Department evidence room so they can charge him. They figure they're safe. It's not like Orice Stevenson's going to complain. I mean, who's going to admit to having even more cocaine than they were caught with?
If you're a drug dealer and you have two prior drug convictions, and the police come and take your money and rob you, is anyone going to believe you?
This is Ivan Bates, a well-known Baltimore defense lawyer. And he's got a good enough reputation that when Orice Stevenson calls his wife from jail, he basically tells her, get Bates.
Wayne Jenkins, I knew who he was. I knew what he did. You know, it was just like a big game in his mind. Ha, 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 I got the power. You're never really going to touch me.
Bates argues his client's car stop was unconstitutional, and the judge agrees. The case is thrown out, and Stevenson's off the hook. But it revealed something interesting about the Jenkins MO. He's fluid with the truth when he writes his arrest reports. He's always eager to get inside people's houses, with or without a warrant. And he'll lie, even in front of a judge, to try to cover it up.
Your clients will tell you really what's happening, and you hear the same story time after time, over and over and over again. You kind of say, you know what, where there's smoke, eventually it's going to be fire.
Ivan Bates had heard rumors for years that Jenkins was up to no good. But he's not the only officer in the gun trace task force with skeletons in his closet.
I can't do this no more, yo. It's either we get it or we don't, or we come close to something. But
that's Jamel Ram.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So I know we could get something, but
he's one of the task force detectives, and his partner in the unit is Mamadou Gondo, the cop with the wiretap on his phone and the bug hidden in his car. Ram joined the police back in 2005. Early on in his career, he made headlines after he shot three people in 20 months, one of them fatally. All three shootings were later deemed justified. He even received the Citation of Valor and Silver Star for one of them. Ram was a tough guy, and he wasn't afraid to use his police badge to shake down unsuspecting members of the public. In June 2009, a guy named Gary Brown was driving near downtown Baltimore on his way to the bank. A friend had asked him to deposit a bunch of cash. Suddenly, Brown saw flashing lights in his rearview mirror. It was Ram and a couple of other cops.
He pulled me over with some dumb excuse. Something about a seatbelt. Get me out the car, sit me on the ground, handcuff me, search the car.
In the trunk, the officers found $11,000 in a paper bag.
He said something to the effect of, yeah, we found this money, we taking it. It's mine. I'm going to the casino with this money. And he took it and put it in his pocket. He said, all right, I'll see you later. And he pulled off.
He was left there, standing by the side of the road.
I was in shock. I didn't really know what was going on. I know I didn't have my money. I was robbed by Baltimore City police. You know, robbed with a gun, armed robbery.
I still find this particular story so crazy. It's not like Gary Brown had drugs or guns. Ram and his colleagues didn't even bother writing a police report. They just robbed the guy in broad daylight. The next morning, after the shock had worn off, Gary Brown did something Detective Ram was not expecting. He made a complaint.
Banged on the door. The police took my money.
The door he's talking about is the entrance to Internal Affairs. It's a special division of the Baltimore Police Department that investigates its own officers. The Internal Affairs Division doesn't enjoy a particularly great reputation or a strong track record of rooting out dirty cops. But this time, they do manage to identify Detective Jamel Ram as one of the officers in the Gary Brown incident. Brown agrees to take a lie detector test.
I passed it.
And Detective Ram? He failed it. Internal Affairs investigators find that Ram lied to them about the robbery. But he's not fired. Instead, he's slapped with a misconduct charge and suspended for 2 years. But there's no record of Gary Brown's $11,000 ever making it to the Baltimore Police Department evidence room.
You know, the months went by, the years went by, just really kind of fell back and let it go.
Police misconduct investigations are secret, and an officer's disciplinary record is not made public in Maryland. So Gary Brown had no idea that Ram was actually suspended following his complaint. But it's not like it did any real damage to Detective Ram's career. When he returned, he was asked to join an elite, powerful, and largely unsupervised plainclothes unit, the Gun Trace Task Force. But Ram is not the only cop who was stealing money before joining the unit. It's early morning, January 2014. Sean Whiting is fast asleep in his skinny row house in West Baltimore. He's got thousands of dollars stashed in his bedroom, some in his closet, some in a bedside table, and still more inside of a vest. There's $8,000 from his job as a house painter and nearly $16,000 from selling heroin. Suddenly, he's jolted awake.
I heard my daughter screaming. I jumped out of my bed. I took maybe 1 to 2 steps. Cop had a gun pointed at my face and told me, get on the ground, get on the ground. And that's what I did. And he cuffed me and took me downstairs.
A trio of plainclothes cops sit Whiting down in his living room and hold up a bag of cash from his closet. They ask him if there's more upstairs. He says there is. And then immediately regrets it.
Once I said that, they kind of like took me out the house.
As well as the cash, Whiting's also got 4.5 kilos of heroin in the house. The plainclothes cops arrest him. And later, in jail, he gets a letter detailing what was seized.
And I was like, it was way more than that.
The letter says that less than $8,000 were found and just 3 kilos of heroin. Whiting's missing more than $16,000 and 1.5 kilos of heroin. He's in jail on a drug charge, but Sean Whiting is mad. He complains to anyone he can think of, the Baltimore Police Department, the FBI. He even tells the judge in his case, I was robbed. The judge assures him it'll be properly investigated. But it won't be. We met Kenneth Baumgartner in part one of this story. In 2016, he was out driving in his old neighborhood. Officers from the Gun Trace Task Force chased him, including Sergeant Wayne Jenkins. Kenneth says the officers robbed him and broke his jaw. A couple of days later, Kenneth has the operation to wire his jaw shut. Because he thinks the officers must have assaulted him and taken his money, he goes to Internal Affairs. But the officer who takes his complaint is aggressive and dismissive and tries to convince him to drop it.
I was like, no, y'all done towed my car, you broke my jaw, and you left me on the ground for dead. No, I'm not leaving it alone. You know, something needs to be done about that.
There's a lot at stake. Because on the night that Kenneth got his injury, his rent money was stolen, and he's now been evicted. And on top of all that, he's got a bill for $67,000 for the smashed-up rental car. He tries his luck with a lawyer, and then another, but each time, he's turned away. They all tell him the same thing. Without some kind of evidence, there's little they can do. For Kenneth, there's just one option left: to turn detective himself. He goes back to the neighborhood where he believes he was assaulted. He's desperate to find someone who saw what happened to him. He starts knocking on doors.
It was a lot of footwork, a lot of walking, I hope somebody is going to step up and be a witness, because, you know, a lot of times people don't want to be a witness when police do things, because bad things happen to people that see things.
He keeps going back day after day.
It took me like a week and a half of knocking on different doors to like actually find a guy that actually seen it. So that was a blessing, I guess.
And with this new witness on board, he now gets a lawyer and starts legal action against the police. Kenneth's not alone. Alongside him, Sean Whiting, Gary Brown, or Reese Stevenson. It's impossible to tell how many other men and women were unlucky enough to come across the officers of the Gun Trace Task Force over the years. FBI Special Agent Erica Jensen is starting to understand the scale of the misconduct and just how many victims the case might have. She pulls the files of people who the squad have arrested over the years and starts combing through them for anything strange. She uncovers evidence that the officers have been lying on their arrest reports, on top of stealing money. The wiretap on Detective Gondo's phone and the hidden bug in his car have revealed some pretty damning behavior, but she really wants to catch the officers in the act, committing a crime. She's got a few more tricks up her sleeve. She could send another cop into the unit undercover to spy on them, but she decides it's too risky. And so is having the officers followed.
Decisions you make in these cases have a lot of repercussions. I mean, you could blow a case by making a bad choice.
So she tries something else. Sometime during the summer of 2016, task force partners Mamadou Gondo and Jamel Ram get a call from county officers outside the city. Would they be willing to check out a suspicious vehicle for them? Gondo and Ram say, sure. It's fairly standard practice for different police agencies to collaborate in this way, so a request like this shouldn't raise any red flags. They're given the address of a rest stop off the side of I-95, a major highway that runs through southeast Baltimore. Gondo and Ram are told that there in the parking lot, they'll find a motorhome. It's a 10-year-old Ford Yellowstone. The FBI agents have already installed a hidden camera. Inside, they've scattered stuff around, tried to make it look a little lived in. And crucially, they've planted $4,500 in marked bills. Bait money. The money's hidden, but not well hidden. FBI Special Agent Erica Jensen is hoping that Ram and Gondo will find the cash and take it, all on camera. With everyone in position, she gives the go-ahead for the county officers to make the call to the task force, asking for assistance. She's miles away, in the FBI war room, listening in.
Pretty much as soon as they got the call, Mr. Rayan was suspicious. Super suspicious. I think he even said, could this be internal affairs? You know, I could hear the sound of their voices. I could hear how concerned they were. It was as if they didn't trust what they were being told.
Instead of approaching the vehicle, they drive around the rest stop, checking it out. It's as if they're casing the place. Not exactly the behavior of a couple of friendly city cops trying to help out their county colleagues.
They're doing things that I did not anticipate.
Then Erica hears something that makes her heart skip a beat. Instead of entering the motorhome, Gondo and Ram are now saying they're going to go check out security camera footage of the parking lot.
You know, we realized that if they started checking footage, that they were going to realize it was a setup. Oh boy, these guys are going to go and look at these cameras. I knew if we got discovered that we might lose the whole case. The whole case might fall apart.
She picks up the phone.
I made the call that we needed to pull the plug.
She has her contacts in the county call Gondo and Ram and tell them, hey, never mind. We actually don't need your help after all. Thanks. It's all good.
It seemed like absolutely the only choice at the time.
Gondo and Ram back off. It's not the result Agent Jensen was hoping for, but she tries to put a brave face on it.
You know, we learned a lot that day, and we learned a lot about them and how they think that day, for sure. It was not a complete waste.
One thing she's learned is just how mistrustful some of the task force officers have become. And those officers aren't the only ones looking over their shoulders in the summer of 2016. There's someone else. And this guy's more tangled up in the crimes of the Gun Trace Task Force than anyone realizes. He's not a member of the task force. He's not even a cop. But he's going to take us down a rabbit hole, deep into the double life of Sergeant Wayne Jenkins, into a conspiracy within a conspiracy.
I'm Donnie Steph, just an interesting guy that unfortunately found myself in a pretty bad situation.
That's next time. You've been listening to Bad Cops from the BBC World Service with me, Jessica Lessenhop. The program was mixed by Neil Churchill, additional mixing by James Beard. The producer is Ben Crichton, and the editor is Richard Varden.